actually through Biden, calling it a pariah state, and at this point not even talking to the crown prince. And it seems like he's going to be making a visit to the region, putting aside all of that and the human rights that Saudi Arabia is obviously violating for oil, because obviously there's a need for it. But is Saudi Arabia going to receive the U.S. president, and is that another U.S. foreign policy failure?
It is. It's a failure because it's obvious that it's the American side that's afraid of the Saudi side, which is kind of bizarre because since World War II, it's the U.S. that's been propping up this regime in Riyadh, arming them. They can't even use a lot of their weapons or fly their own planes, so the Americans send over their pilots and advisors and technicians and stuff. So it's really been kind of a U.S. Proxy state where the Americans get a deal. They have the Saudis export the oil only in dollars, and the Americans get the right to sell all the military equipment, make a lot of money. And the Americans have been the dominant party for a long time. And last time the Saudis got uppity was actually right before 9/11 in August. The king said that Saudi Arabia was going to have to go its own way and leave the U.S. empire because of the U.S. support for Israel. And then suddenly 9/11 happened, and a bunch of high-level Saudis who had supported that policy suddenly died. And then the next thing you know, Saudi Arabia has been reeled in. So the U.S. seemed like it was still in charge. But now they're not anymore. Now the clown prince can, you know, we all see him as a clown prince, but he's got the upper hand over the Americans somehow. He can tell them, he can refuse to take their phone calls. They call him begging him to pump more oil, and he doesn't even take the phone call. And so then Biden abjectly drops all of his demands for any kind of improvement on human rights and just goes there with his begging bowl to the king, to the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Okay. So somehow what's happened here? Apparently the U.S. has lost so much prestige and so much soft power and perhaps hard power as well, losing the war in Syria, allowing the Russians to win in Georgia even before that. And now the Russians are on course to defeat NATO and win in Ukraine as well. And so the U.S. is a fading power. And Biden's abject surrender to the Saudis is a sign of that.
Okay. Talk about money, since I've heard that now in the statements. Lawrence Davidson, it was very shocking in a sense for many when the Afghanistan war and U.S. occupation there was ongoing, that the Pentagon comes out and says, we don't even know how much money we have spent. Because based on the accounting that took place, they couldn't account for billions of dollars, and I'm talking hundreds of billions of dollars, that was cited in a report. We can go on about that, but I'm curious as to whether these ventures, which all cost money, is about money.
Well, yes, I think that it's a lot of it is about money, and the nature of these ventures essentially creates a sphere or a environment for corruption. I mean, when you are distributing, you know, either in actual dollars or in materiel, millions and millions and millions of dollars per week, some of that is going to generate corruption. And corruption then becomes its own engine. So essentially, if you're not paying attention, or on purpose or otherwise, or if you don't care how the money is spent, then, or how the money ultimately is distributed, then in fact it's an invitation for not being able to account for billions of bucks.
Okay, thank you, Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, and thank you, Lawrence Davidson, emeritus professor at Westchester University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Afghanistan is facing an urgent need for medical supplies to provide treatment for thousands of injuries following the recent tragic earthquake. Fresh violence by Israeli occupation forces takes the life of one more Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. Also coming up, the U.S. economy on its path towards recession. The International Monetary Fund slashes the country's growth forecast. Thank you for joining us. In Afghanistan, five more people have died in an aftershock in almost the same area of a major quake in the east on Wednesday. That adds to over 1,000 people killed on the day the natural disaster happened. There has been no immediate word on the extent of new damage and injuries. The country's disaster ministry says over 2,000 were injured on Wednesday. It also says around 10,000 houses were partially or completely destroyed. Authorities have ended a search for survivors. The 6.1 magnitude quake was the strongest to hit Afghanistan in over two decades. Officials say the country lacks the necessities to treat the injured or provide the survivors with food, water, and shelter. A number of countries have offered emergency aid. Three humanitarian aid flights from Iran have landed in Afghanistan.
After a nine-hour-long trip from the Afghan capital Kabul, we have arrived in Gayan district in southeastern Paktika province. The residents have to stay outdoors in the cold weather, without access to basic needs.
All houses here have been ruined as a result of the earthquake. In some areas, all members of a single family have been killed. Currently, women, children, and elders are in a very bad situation and need urgent help.
Next day, as the sun rises, we visit more quake-ravaged houses. People still continue the search and rescue operation. It seems like every home here has had some killed or injured.
Mr. Naim Khan says that he has lost two of his relatives and five others are injured. We ask him about this earthquake and about the situation here.
At around 1:30 a.m. Wednesday, the earthquake struck here. Two of my family members were killed and five others injured. We also lost our livestock. Our livelihoods and food supplies are buried under rubble. There's nowhere to go. We need help and our houses should be rebuilt.
Four of the Taliban ministers and aid agencies arrived in the collapsed villages to address the needs of desperate people. They're providing food items, blankets, tents, medicines, and other basic necessities. But it's clear more help is needed.
The leadership has ordered all related governmental institutions to reach the quake-stricken areas and take necessary measures. In addition, the Prime Minister is going to pay money to families of the victims.
Humanitarian aid agencies have arrived here to carry out the required programs. Based on our assessment, more than 8,000 houses have so far been confirmed destroyed here in Gayan. These affected people need help immediately.
The earthquake comes as Afghanistan is facing drought, famine, and hunger, triggered by cuts in global aid and the U.S. sanctions. The Taliban officials have called on the U.S. to release Afghan frozen assets. Rahmatullah Baghban, Paktika province of Afghanistan.
Now, to get the latest updates with regard to that earthquake and its aftershock in eastern Afghanistan, I'm now joined by Abdullah Amirzada. He's our correspondent in Kabul. Thank you for joining us. So tell us more about the main earthquake that hit Afghanistan on Wednesday and its aftershock on Friday. Tell us about the state of those who survived the earthquake and those who are now injured.
Yes, as you know, on the beginning hours of Wednesday, 22nd of June, an earthquake, powerful 6.1 to the magnitude of Richter scale, hit some eastern provinces of Afghanistan. Almost 80% of houses near the epicenter were destroyed. It killed many and wounded many more. People lost their homes. They have no shelter, no food. They have no medical. What they need now is the aid that comes from other countries, including shelter, food, medical aids. Unfortunately, another earthquake yesterday hit those eastern provinces on 24th of June at around 10 a.m. and killed five persons, unfortunately, and it caused 11 persons to get wounded. During past days, neighboring countries have been sending their shipments to help aid, to help these people who were struck by the earthquake. Among them, Islamic Republic of Iran, Pakistan, India sent shipments, and Islamic Republic of Iran sent its third shipment yesterday, which arrived to eastern provinces. Airborne shipments I'm talking about. There are some trucks ready to be sent. They are on the road. They are arriving to the country, and they are leading to those eastern provinces. People in other provinces are gathering aids for the ones in need. They are gathering blankets, money. They are gathering prepared food, canned food, and they are sending then with other small shipments to those provinces. Unfortunately, in the region, the transmission towers were destroyed. It is almost impossible to have a connection with them. No internet is working, no cell phone is working, no electricity. And these are some of the hardships that people are facing in those provinces.
Thank you so much, Abdullah Amirzada, our correspondent in the Afghan capital, Kabul, for the updates that you gave us. Moving on, a Palestinian teenager has succumbed to injuries he sustained by Israeli gunfire in the occupied West Bank on Friday. Israeli forces hit 16-year-old Mohammed Hamad during a raid in the town of Silwat. He is the second Palestinian to fall victim to Israeli violence in a week. The other one was killed near the Galgilia refugee camp. Israeli forces had accused him of trying to cross the separation barrier. The situation remains volatile across the occupied territories, with Israeli forces and settlers keeping up their acts of violence against Palestinians. Troops often resort to live rounds, citing different pretexts against Palestinians protesting against raids or illegal demolition of their homes. Tel Aviv has also intensified detaining Palestinians, including children, who are being held without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. Our correspondent Mona Kandil has joined us from Ramallah, telling us more about Israeli brutalities and the killing of another Palestinian at the hands of the regime's forces. Take a listen.
Israeli forces usually on Fridays raid Palestinian areas to prevent anti-Israel demonstrations and protests. These are protests that take place in order to be against the Israeli settlements and the Israeli separation wall and the confiscation of the land. This is what happened yesterday. Israeli troops raided Silwat town, East Ramallah, and they used their fire. They fired towards Palestinians. who were taking part in an anti-settlement protest in Silwad. 16-year-old Muhammad Abdullah Hamid from Silwad was shot and wounded, and the Israeli troops took him when they pulled out from the Palestinian town of Silwad. Later, the Israeli military declared that this 16-year-old Palestinian succumbed to his injuries. However, we have to mention that the body of Muhammad Abdullah Hamid is still with the Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians had been also wounded yesterday, Friday, in numerous locations in the occupied West Bank.
An investigation by the UN Human Rights Office has concluded that veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aghla was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Aghla and her fellow journalists covering an Israeli raid in Jenin were targeted by, quote, seemingly well-aimed bullets. More in this report.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aghla was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Aghla came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Aghla, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Aghla and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Aghla in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Aghla's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
The chairman of the International Monetary Fund says the United States is facing an increased risk of recession. Kristalina Georgieva warned that there is a narrowing path for the U.S. to avoid recession. The warning comes as the Federal Reserve introduced the biggest rise in its benchmark lending rate in nearly 30 years to tame the rallying prices. U.S. inflation is at a four-decade high. This is squeezing American families, struggling with inflated costs of fuel, food, and housing. The IMF chief also pointed to the Russia-Ukraine war and what she called the uncertainty of the current situation. She warned that further negative shocks would inevitably make the situation more difficult. Jack Rasmus is a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College. He says that at this point, the U.S. cannot avoid a recession, and it's only a matter of how soon it will happen.
I don't think the U.S. can avoid a recession. The only question is how soon, how deep, and how long. Mm-hmm. When you raise interest rates this quickly, and we got to assume that the Fed's going to continue doing that a couple more times, 75 basis points. When you raise interest rates that fast, the historical record shows that you always fall into a recession. And that's especially true now, I think, because the U.S. economy contracted in the first quarter of this year. And the forecast by the Atlanta District Fed is that there'll be no growth in the second quarter. So, you know, we're almost on the cusp of a recession already. And now we're raising interest rates at the pace that they indicate. I've been predicting for over 6 months now that should the Fed raise interest rates, then we're going to have a recession. You know, the IMF is always very conservative. It's always lagging behind the actual trend in the economy, the global economy, the U.S. economy, very conservative in its forecast. It always adjusts further when reality changes.
Triple blows to the British Prime Minister as the chairman of his ruling Conservative Party steps down following defeats in Thursday's parliamentary by-elections. Premier Boris Johnson has admitted that the vote results were tough and said he has to listen to voters. Johnson also implied that the deepening cost of living crisis is to blame for the defeat. The Premier, however, fell short of talking about the resignation of the Tories' chairman. Oliver Dowden has said it would not be right for him to remain in office. He added the by-elections are the latest in the Tories' poor results. They lost their seat to the opposition Labour Party in Wakefield, Northern England, after 3 years. Labour says the result shows there is no trust in the Tories.
He said unreservedly, Boris Johnson, your contempt for this country is no longer tolerated. The big issues facing our country, it's not acceptable that a quarter of our children in Wakefield live in poverty. It's not acceptable that hundreds of people leave A&E every month without being treated because of record NHS waiting times. And it's not acceptable.
The Conservatives also lost their seat to Liberal Democrats in Tiverton and Honiton, southwest England, after over a century. The failures come hot on the heels of a major setback for Johnson after he narrowly escaped a no-confidence vote earlier this month. The British Prime Minister has been grappling with a series of scandals, including the so-called Partygate. Iranian national Hamid Nouri, who is held in Sweden over alleged rights abuse, says he has been physically tortured by the police. In a short phone call with his family, Nouri revealed for the first time that he was beaten hard by three police officers. Nouri said he is still being kept in solitary confinement, nearly 2 months after his trial ended. He said his conditions have worsened. That's why the overseeing judge had called for the restrictions placed on him to be lifted. Nouri is awaiting the court's ruling and says he is still denied access to an ophthalmologist despite having a serious eye condition. The Iranian national was arrested in 2019 over allegations of human rights violation against members of the anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen Khalq back in the 1980s. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for him. Iran rejects the, quote, baseless allegation against Nouri and says his trial is a political show. And that concludes this edition of World News. Thank you for your company.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The only solution to thwart U.S. hegemony is to firm up resistance based on genuine Islamic values, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown and has inspired masses in the neighborhood and beyond to stand up to outside pressures through faith, unity, self-confidence, and formation of popular mobilization units, which are all capable of defeating American imperialism, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Faith, Unity, and Resistance Thwarts U.S. Devilish Designs. Stay tuned for more. There is some grain of truth when former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan says that it was U.S. meddling which shoved him out of office last April. In a recent interview to the Sunday Times, he blasted the U.S. for its imperial arrogance, revealing that his ambassador in Washington had received a message from U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for South Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, who had threatened Pakistan with consequences if Imran Khan remained in power as premier. In the past 40 years, our leadership has basically bowed down on everything the U.S. has demanded for us, said the one-time star cricketer who, in 1970s, had captained Pakistan to victory in the World Cup.
This hardly seems to be an unfounded claim or an exaggeration when we, in Iran, after ending in 1979, a quarter century of American control over our country, have, over the past 42 years, been exposed to the intensity of U.S. devilish designs through war, invasion, cultural crimes, economic terrorism, political pressures, and the current threats regarding our own inalienable right to enrich uranium for our IAEA-certified peaceful nuclear projects. The U.S., without the least doubt, is the great Satan, and resistance is the only way to defeat it. In order to remain independent, powerful, progressive, unified, self-sufficient, self-dignified, and above all, loyal to Islam and the dynamic teachings of Prophet Muhammad and his immaculate Ahlul Bayt, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In other words, if the Yankees get the slightest chance to yank any of these values, you would simply devour it in the most savage manner. This is evident by the sorry state of affairs in neighboring Afghanistan, which the U.S. occupied for two decades, and now after withdrawal of its troops has not only blocked billions of dollars of Afghan assets, but is actively spreading terrorism through Daesh and similar outfits to further destabilize the country. The same is true for the situation in Iraq, where a government has still not been formed 8 long months after holding the general elections, mainly because of undue American meddling and unabated plunder of the country's vast oil reserves, while the political parties bicker over trivial matters. Syria is another country in our neighborhood which the U.S. destroyed through macabrely murderous terrorists of all hue and color, and continues to destabilize not just through its occupation forces, but also by ordering the Zionist regime to indulge in almost daily aerial attacks for President Bashar al-Assad's refusal to bow to Washington's pressures. Then there is Lebanon, where the resolve of a sizable section of people to remain independent has prompted the U.S. to resort to all sorts of intrigues to try to ruin its economy and political system. Yemen, for the past 7 years, is engulfed in flames of war as a result of its invasion by the U.S. client states of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, whose cultish and clannish regimes do not want peace and stability in the Arabian Peninsula's only country having democratic institutions and not subject to hereditary rule. Palestine, groaning for the past 74 years under the jackboots of the illegal Zionist migrants of Eastern Europe, remains an open wound on human conscience. And there will be no solution to the people's plight even if the resistance groups were to express their readiness to accept the U.S. Zionist yoke. The list of American interference is endless and spread all over the globe, including Europe, Africa, and Latin America, where Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua stand as prime examples of countries subjected to U.S. state terrorism. In view of these undeniable facts, the only solution to thwart U.S. hegemony is to firm up resistance based on genuine Islamic values, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown and has inspired masses in the neighborhood and beyond to stand up to outside pressures through faith, unity, self-confidence, and formation of popular mobilization units, which are all capable of defeating American imperialism.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Puppet government in the heart of Africa.
Part 1.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June 30, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. Ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa.
rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the prime minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The prime minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December 1, 1960, as the prime minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the prime minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sote. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. We are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. 9 African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002 the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
In the limelight.
Targeting the healthcare sector is a grave crime against humanity, and in further analysis of global health policy, it is imperative we address Israeli regime's action as such, says Emily Hacker, writer, in an article published under the heading, Israeli regime's assaults on public health infrastructure amount to war crimes. Stay tuned for more. In May 2021, the Zionist regime military dropped hundreds of bombs on the Gaza Strip, destroying houses, schools, businesses, and healthcare facilities. Perhaps nowhere was the human toll of that month more apparent than at Al-Shifa Hospital, the only hospital in Gaza equipped for emergency assistance. Doctors worked for days on end, rarely sleeping or eating and unable to see their families as they frantically treated hundreds of wounded Palestinian patients, at least those patients who could actually reach the hospital. Outside the hospital grounds, streets were so badly damaged by the Zionist regime's airstrikes that paramedics struggled to bring patients directly to Al-Shifa. In the span of those 11 days in May, the Zionist regime occupation forces wreaked havoc on Gaza's already precarious public health system, damaging or destroying 19 medical centers, including the offices of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, a nonprofit that provides cancer treatment and medical prosthetics to children who are unable to seek care outside of Gaza due to Israeli regime blockade. The Israeli regime's military actions in 2021 were, unfortunately, nothing new. Numerous Israeli bombing campaigns have damaged or destroyed primary health infrastructure in the occupied Gaza Strip, including clinics and hospitals, as well as key public health services like water treatment facilities, sewage treatment plants, and electrical grids. This is not accidental. the Zionist regime relies on, among other strategies, the destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure, the targeting of medical personnel, and inhibiting Palestinian access to healthcare to enforce its regime of apartheid. Yet, Western health officials often overlook these acts, which are nothing short of war crimes, and this passive complicity violates promise as healthcare professionals to do no harm. The physical and mental health of the Palestinian people is a central component of Palestinian liberation and must be discussed as such. The Zionist regime's military offensives against Palestine have both created and exacerbated existing public health concerns within the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Beginning with the Nakba in 1948, the Israeli regime has made it a matter of policy to destroy not only Palestinian homes and communities, but clinics, hospitals, and other health infrastructure. Israeli airstrikes on Gaza in 2021 damaged or destroyed numerous clinics, a water treatment facility, and infrastructure related to COVID-19 testing and treatment. Nearly 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza were injured during the Zionist regime's May 2021 military assault, and hospitals were overwhelmed. The outright destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure, such as the bombing of a clinic operated by Doctors Without Borders, is accompanied by direct physical violence against healthcare personnel. The Israeli regime military have killed medical professionals, including doctors Ayman Abu Al-Auf and Mo'in Al-Aul in 2021, and paramedic Razan Al-Najjar, who was killed by Israeli snipers in 2018. Often, leaders and pillars of their communities, doctors killed by the Israeli regime military, leave behind both a physical and psychological void of healthcare and security. The actions of the fake regime of Israel and occupying military forces are indefensible by any interpretation and international humanitarian law, yet they are ignored at every opportunity by world leaders. In no other country and in no other war could such actions be left unaddressed by the Western medical community. Along with the destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure and the targeted killings of Palestinian healthcare workers, the Israeli regime imposes draconian restrictions on the movement of Palestinians seeking healthcare in Gaza and the West Bank. Medical travel permits are often delayed, lost, or ignored by Israeli regime occupation forces operating checkpoints out of Gaza. Figures from the World Health Organization estimate that the Israeli regime and military accepted only 54% of medical travel permits in 2017. Blockades and checkpoints operated by Israeli regime occupation forces grossly impede not only the day-to-day freedoms of Palestinians, but prevent ambulances from transporting critically ill and injured patients. Despite the close proximity of the Israeli and Palestinian populations, infant and maternal mortality rates remain markedly higher for Palestinians, and life expectancy is almost 10 years shorter. The rates of stroke, hypertension, coronary artery disease, diabetes, and neonatal disorders range from 3 to 7 times higher for Palestinians as compared with Israelis. This is by design. The Israeli regime has removed or prevented the construction of systems of care and residences, denying building permits and demolishing homes. Living under a regime of occupation and apartheid carries with it a heavy physical toll, one that cannot be adequately expressed through statistics. We'll be right back. Bodily integrity and bodily health are identified as key components to individual prosperity. The right of self-determination and Palestinian liberation are incumbent upon the general health of the Palestinian population, both of which the Zionist regime aims to destroy. The healthcare workers and public health personnel living and working under Israeli regime occupation are a testament to Palestinian strength and resistance, and public health officials in Palestine must have their calls to action echoed by their colleagues internationally. Outside of Palestine, healthcare professionals should be among the first to apply pressure to Western regimes to end funding absent a change of Israeli regime behavior and to condemn and uncover Israeli war crimes. Targeting the healthcare sector is a grave crime against humanity, and in further analysis of global health policy, it is imperative we address the Zionist regime action as such.